Hey, Jeff Johnston here with the Living Undeterred podcast. This is a first for the show. All of our other guests have been in studio. So this is the first time we've done a virtual studio guest. So Storyline Multimedia does an awesome job and everything is set up for a great show. So I am excited to do this a little bit outside of my comfort zone today. Normally I'm used to having someone here. Dr. Richard Lopez, I'm going to introduce him quickly here and let our conversation kind of introduce who he is. Met him a short while ago and just fell in love with what he's doing with neuroscience and behavioral health tech and digital apps and youth mental wellness, and checked all the boxes. So I, after getting to know him and after working on some collaborative efforts, I invited him to come on the show and basically start talking about this big problem, this epidemic out there. That is, you know, specifically today we'll be focused very heavy on youth mental wellness. But as we know, mental wellness doesn't discriminate, and the collateral damage in a family when one person struggles, as I know, you know, our story, it can have, you know, legacy impacts for a long time. And so we're trying to really prevent any family ever going through what we went through and what millions and millions of families deal with, not just in the United States, but globally. So, Rich, nice to see you, and I'm excited to start talking about this topic.
Yeah, me too, Jeff. I'm so honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, for our listeners that aren't really in tune with the definition of all these terms, I'm sure we could plug in into ChatGPT and figure out pretty quickly what a social neuroscientist is. But in human terms, or I guess in English, as my dad used to say, what does that really mean? What does that term mean?
Yeah, so social neuroscience is a pretty new field. I mean, by most measures, it's only about 20 or 30 years old at most. And really, it's a matter of understanding how our brain helps us to be social, to connect, how we express our emotions, how we regulate our emotions. How do we understand what another person is thinking and feeling? A lot of these questions, social psychologists have studied for quite a long time. Since mm-hmm. the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But now, with the development of all these interesting neurotech tools and even non-invasive brain imaging techniques like fMRI, we mm-hmm. now get to peek inside the brain as people are thinking about themselves and other people and their relationships. So a social neuroscientist, at the end of the day, is interested in what makes us human, what makes us social, and using the latest technology regarding brain function and measuring brain activity. To get at that.
So what drew you into this field? Like all the different choices you could have taken a career path, how'd you end up in this one?
Yeah, so when I started my undergrad career, I knew I wanted to major in psychology, but I didn't really know that there was this field, this growing field called social neuroscience. So I had the major blessing and opportunity to work in a social neuroscience lab as an undergrad. And at the time, we were looking at how do we trust other people? How do we make judgments of another person's trustworthiness based on very quick impressions? Mm-hmm. And just the fact that psychologists and neuroscientists can be able to ask these questions and study these phenomena, just it got me hooked very early on. But I'm dating myself a little bit, but when I was an undergrad, this was the mid to late 2000s, but the world has changed so much since then. I mean, I had a separate digital Olympus camera to take pictures. I had a flip phone at the time to text and connect and call, right? So technology has accelerated so much since I was an undergrad through my graduate training and now that I'm even more interested in what's going on in our brain, what's going on in our brains, what are we thinking and feeling as we interact with each other in these different ways. And I think there are a lot of positives, but I think there are a lot of possible risks and negatives as well. And psychologists and neuroscientists, I think we're needed more than ever to be able to speak into what's going on and promote kind of wellness and overall health when it comes to how we use these different technologies and what it does to us socially and emotionally.
Well, I'll date myself then, because when I was younger, you know, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have most of what people have today. Mm-hmm. Yet, I think those were happier times for mm-hmm. young adults. I really do. Mm-hmm. I look back at I was born in 66. So, you know, I grew up in the late 70s, mm-hmm. early mm-hmm. 80s. And even though we lacked what people would consider abundance today, I just think a lot of us had more enjoyable experiences in high school and college. And that to me is the ultimate dynamic or dichotomy, I guess, in this whole, especially for Brighton, because we're trying to normalize these conversations. We're trying to get information to people quicker so they can self-assess and autonomous learn and all that stuff. Not self-diagnose, but autonomous learning. And in doing so, I often wonder, you know, where is this shift going to happen where we start seeing young adults and in high school, college kids, and even Generation Alpha now, which is behind Gen Z. You know, are you confident that the pace of what we're doing with all these great things, that if you just go back and look at simpler times, it seems to me that people were, quote, better off?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say that it depends what the end goal is. I think with a lot of the ways that social media apps have been developed, they're meant to keep you engaged and keep you hooked.
And addicted. And they're meant to keep you addicted.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's this constant consumption. But I think with an app like Brighton and other apps and tools that are being developed and will be developed, if it can center a person and get them grounded in who they are, what they care about, their sense of purpose, all of these things, and then that causes them then to engage in the real world in ways that are impactful and gets them offline, I think that's going to be one of the key pieces in all of this and how it's going to impact a person's life and interactions when they're not using technology, like using technology to get them to a point to be more autonomously motivated, for example, to pursue their, you know, a set of goals, to pursue values, and then that having downstream positive impacts in the real world and shaping them into just a more resilient human being.
I know the way the algorithms are designed on, you know, platforms like, you know, Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok, you know, it doesn't take long if you start off with good intentions. You know, I want to follow, you know, Dr. Lopez. I want to follow Andrew Huberman. You know, I want to follow these people that, you know, you know, profess to be throwing out some pretty valuable information.
Yep.
But once you click on a fight in a Walmart parking lot, just because, you know, and we drive by, we call it rubbernecking back in the day. You're looking out the car. It's human nature to be curious of chaos. I mean, it's not that we're wishing it upon somebody, but there's something about that, I don't know if it's dopamine, serotonin, whatever hits your body when you see something like that.
Yes.
And so when you click on one of those, just by just curiosity, not because you're supporting a fight in a Walmart parking lot. You just want to see how it ends. You know, one guy's being a jerk, the other guy's a nice guy. You're cheering for the nice guy to win. You know how we all do.
It starts off so innocently.
Then within just a matter, I was on this last night because one of our posts we made just hit 500,000 views, which is the most viral we've ever done on TikTok. And it was a post of a penguin talking about misunderstanding texting. You know, like. Right. It's funny, but it was like 500,000 views.
Yes.
And, you know, that's one of the benefits, I guess, of social media. You get little funny things like that, that you laugh at, but man, the algorithm is just so insidious and so evil and so scary because the young mind, the prefrontal cortex, as you know, isn't formed till now. They're keep pushing it back. You know, maybe it's 27 now. I don't know, but these kids are 14, 15, 16, 18, 19. It's hard enough to be that age at puberty and everything else. And now you got these algorithms that are feeding on that insecurity and gaslighting and imposter syndrome.
So
I don't know if I have a question in there. I guess what I'm trying to pull out of you is I still want to figure out where your optimism is that we can build things. And again, I'm optimistic because I'm the CEO and founder of an app that does this, but where does your, as a neuroscientist, where does your optimism come from?
Yeah. So my optimism comes from the fact that as human beings, regardless of how old we are and where we are in our development, that we are very adaptive and adaptable, and we can still have, you know, major say in what we want to do with our lives, what we want to pursue. And even though brain development mostly ends, you know, around, you know, mid-20s, like we were saying, with final kind of maturity of prefrontal cortex, the brain is always changing and adapting based on experiences and interactions. So someone who might be going down a pretty, concerning path, regardless of what they're experiencing, if they have a connection with someone, or they can reflect more on who they are, who they care about, what they care about. Their life trajectory, it's not mm-hmm. overly dramatic to say their whole life trajectory can change. Mm-hmm. And our brains are so well equipped for us to do that, because mm-hmm. our brains are constantly taking information and making predictions about what will happen, what could happen. But we care about ourselves and other people. Like, we're social creatures. And I think the social connection aspect of who we are, like, never goes away. It changes a little bit throughout our lives and what relationships we have. But we are adaptive and resilient in a lot of key ways. And that never ends. It doesn't matter how old you are.
Mm-hmm. So I was listening to you talk a little bit, and it made me think about projecting your thoughts, because I saw a statistic the other day. I think it was we have 10,000 thoughts a day. That thought was low, actually. I think I have 10,000 a minute. but we have 10,000 thoughts a day, and 90% of them are either thinking about the past, things that we just can't do anything about. And we're projecting about future events that are 82% negative. I think that when you project a future event, we're predisposed to assume the worst. And so you're literally setting yourself up for disaster if you're living, 10% of your time in the present. Yeah. But the rest of it's wrapped up in telling yourself stories that are really, not servicing you well, because they're not relevant today.
Right.
They may form the foundation, like losing my son and my wife, that mm-hmm. formed a foundation mm-hmm. for what I do. But talking about it constantly in a suffering angle is not serving me anymore. Mm-hmm. But then turning around and projecting things in the future, fear and scarcity and worry and dread, which, I do, we all do, it's mm-hmm. normal. But mm-hmm. how do we find a way to get people to start being more present in really what we have? I mean, I heard someone say the other day that, if you died yesterday, mm-hmm. so yesterday was your last day on earth, mm-hmm. but you got a free pass to come back today, but you knew you died yesterday, how much would you value today? This is the first day of the rest of your life.
Right.
How much would you value today?
Right.
And that's just reframing.
Right. Right.
How powerful is that?
No, for sure. And, I and others have studied cognitive reappraisal and how the brain helps support that. And that's exactly that gets at the reframing piece. I think being able to take a step back and understand kind of the whole, experience, good, bad, ugly, everything in between, rather than just fixating on the negative. I mean, evolutionarily, it's good that we were wired for negativity, because back, hundreds of thousands of years ago, there were dire physical threats, so that
dinosaur would eat you or something.
That was the context in which our brains evolved. So it makes sense that we skew negative a lot of the time when we're prospecting and thinking, about the future and thinking about possible outcomes. But since we live in a time where that physical threat for most of us doesn't exist anymore, but we still have the same neural hardware, right, mm-hmm. that gets us into that mindset, we can fall into these ruts of negativity, but we also have the ability to get ourselves out of those ruts, to reframe. But then also with this hypothetical, if you died yesterday and then you came back and got a free pass and to appreciate life again, taking a step back and just being grateful and practicing gratitude is huge. And maybe you've heard of these studies because they've become pretty popular, but it turns out that if you write a letter to someone in your life who made an impact to you, and then hand deliver the letter to them, and then read the letter to them, and you sit down and read it out. I mean, everyone is bawling by the end of it because it's a very emotional experience. But just thinking of ways we can practice gratitude for what we have and for the time we still have here on earth is so important. And all of these capacities are part of how we're wired and how our brains have developed.
I'm sorry. Even though I had a finance major in college, I had a really heavy psych. Mm-hmm. I was like one or two credits short from having an official psych minor. Mm-hmm. But I was always intrigued by Stoic philosophy. Like, I was mm-hmm. really into Stoicism in college, but mm-hmm. kind of forgot about it. Raised kids, and then all of a sudden, I had these things happen in my life it made me start thinking of, okay, I need to go. I don't want to drink again. I don't want to do things to numb. I don't want to take prescription pills. I just, to me, I was more like, what are some like free resources out there? And then I thought, wow, what's that thing I studied in college? I started looking at Stoicism and, you know, reframing is a core tenet of Stoicism. Yeah. You know, I'm reading Meditations now for like the fourth time with Marcus Aurelius. And it's interesting how that ancient wisdom you can pull forward to today and it's so applicable. But I was going to ask you, we've talked about negative thoughts, we've talked about projections, but what about people that bring negativity into your life? So let's say, let's say now you're sitting there and you're having a good day. So you've been struggling for a while, let's say, and you're just having a good day. And then you have that conversation with that person and that person's having their own issues. They're having their own mental health challenges. And so immediately the conversation kind of starts to bring you down. And so you're trying to fight. So maybe you don't say anything.
Right.
Because the more you talk, you're just going to fuel. Yes. And I'm saying this because I think we all have this. And I'm sure I've been that negative person to somebody. So I'm not being judgmental.
Yeah. Right.
I haven't always been, you know, positive. It's very, very human to be have negative thoughts. But I mean, for that person who's kind of got their own stuff figured out, the reason I'm asking you this is one core tenet of Stoicism, again, is focus on things that you can control, like your control zone, you know?
Yes.
So from that standpoint, when somebody projects negativity or, Debbie Downer, I guess is the term that they use for when I grew up.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on teens today, young adults today, how they can reassess, like, you know, what do you do when someone, you know, you don't want to just ignore them because they're struggling. Right. They need help, but you don't want them to bring you down either.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to that. I think with respect to young people, so much of their experience and perception based on what they encounter on social media, it's just drenched in negativity and outrage and victimization and all of these things. And I mean, I think if it's an in-person interaction, so I think we have to make a distinction first. If you're having this negative encounter with someone, is it in-person or online? But if it's in-person, I think it depends on the nature of the relationship and what boundaries you want to place. Because I think in that moment, there's very little you can do about that person's, what they're going through and their negativity. And to protect yourself, just knowing that it's not in your control and that even if you love and care for them very much, if they're a very close family member, a close friend, just knowing that you're not going to solve it in that moment. And I mean, I like to solve problems, you know, and I'm a scientist, problems greatly interest me, but knowing in that moment, you can't really do much at all, but just be present, listen well, listen actively. And then really it's the next step that requires the wisdom and the discernment to say, okay, we've had this interaction before, like let's say it happened last week, what can be done next to help this person? So in the moment, it's very easy for that negativity to be contagious and for you to be affected by it. But I think strategizing and thinking, okay, what can be done to provide help and support for this person going forward? And also the thing is, if it's a pattern and it's really a chronic pattern where it's like almost like every other interaction with them is like this, then I would say that rises to the occasion of, okay, there should be some open discussion of boundaries and kind of what's going on here, because that could have a negative impact on you. But of course, you still want to be there and to help and support the person. I mean, depending on the nature of the problem, it may involve referrals to professional help or other mechanisms. There are many ways it could go. So I think it depends on the interaction, who the person is. Is it a pattern? Is there something deeper going on? But just knowing that we don't have much control over the other person's reactions and interpretations, what's going on in their life. But we still have the power and the ability to reframe and to take a step back and to try to keep a broader perspective. You're probably familiar with Viktor Frankl.
Man Search for Meaning is probably one of the best books I've ever read. Read it twice.
So I'm overdue. I need to read it again. I read it when I was younger, so I'm way overdue. So I'm going to return to that book soon. Now that I'm in a totally different life stage, but thinking about Frankl and just his insight and drawing from a lot of ancient philosophical traditions of just, no, even in the midst of horrible suffering and so much tragedy, you still have the ability to make meaning and remake meaning via reframing. And I think that's so critical for us to practice that and for that to become a habit of mind, if you will, and how we approach situations.
Especially when you have, suffering thrown into the loop. You know, it's one thing to have depression over finances or you know, something, but when you have this, you know, intense suffering that you've been through.
Yes, absolutely.
He said, suffering will be my opportunity. And that's what he said in that book. And I actually stole and reframed it, stoically reframed it, I guess. I said, pain is unavoidable, suffering is a choice. And if you think about that, the pain of a certain event, losing a child, breaking your leg, whatever, you know, there's pain involved there that you're not just going to be able to say, oh, I'm not going to feel the pain of burying someone I care about.
That's right.
Or losing a marriage or losing a business. You know, there's pain with that. But the suffering, that is optional, at least the duration of it, like how much you want to identify with it, how much you want to cling onto it.
Yes.
And so, again, using all that into our day-to-day lives, you know, you're going through something, you know, somebody backs out of a business deal, somebody, you know, there's something that comes up that involves pain in your life.
Yes.
You really have to look at it as, okay, that was unavoidable. And if it was avoidable, what was the lesson? Like maybe I messed up. Maybe the person didn't renew the contract because of me.
Right.
But how long you dwell in that?
Yes.
It really, really, really is
yes.
an absolute in your head only. No one else, no one else in the history of humanity is going through the same situation.
That's right.
You're the only person.
That's right.
So you, that's how much control you have over the suffering.
Right. Right. And
you have,
the
you have all the control.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And those, so there's little nuggets in that book that I pulled away from that I now use, and I read it like 6 years ago. So,
absolutely. Yeah, and for what it's worth too, for me, my own personal faith and the faith tradition that I ascribe to, like that also helps me understand suffering and the role of suffering and how it could transform a person. And there's a lot of power in that as well. But like you're saying, to ruminate and to dwell and to stay in that place, that is, it's common. And I get it. You know, like I've heard so many people, like when they're going through something, like I've experienced it from, you know, different measures in my life. I get that's a very human and common pattern, but I think there is an opportunity to go beyond it and to transcend it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, making an effort to write things down when you're struggling, and it's journaling is what I'm referring to now.
Yep.
You know, back in the day when I did journaling, you know, you wrote it on a piece of paper and you, you know, put it in a drawer. And then when you remembered, you came back and pulled it out and wrote some more.
Yep.
And it turned out to be almost a diary.
Yeah.
And at some point you kind of got tired of it. You got bored of it. Because it was repetitive and it was not really rewarding. And it was kind of like Groundhog Day over and over and over.
Right.
You put it in the drawer and you wouldn't look at it till, you know, years and years. Then you're going through your old baseball card collection. Oh, there's my old. Yeah. But that's the journaling I grew up in.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, I'm sure there was evidence that people who journaled well back in the 80s, 90s or 2000s, whatever. And then you see this technology coming out. Now you can like journal on your computer and stuff.
Yep.
And now with AI, it's changed. It's changed everything. So when I say journaling, I think a lot of people that are like my age or, you know, 45 and older are thinking of the antiquated journaling.
Yes.
But now with AI and large language models and this ability to go back and merge previous entries and you can teach the AI certain behavior, whether the AI is empathetic or direct or caring, you know, whatever, is simply amazing. And I know on the app, it's one of our most popular features on the app. And so I guess I wanted kind of a general, your thoughts on just journaling in general, and then the future of AI and where you can see this can, you know, really be a great bridge or a tether for people that are in between sessions with their therapist, or maybe they're not, you know, 4 out of 5 people, 80% are not needing to go to therapy. They don't need to be on prescription pills for meds for antidepressants. So we're looking at the majority of people journaling. Journaling is actually better than the other options because they're not in crisis mode yet.
Right, right.
But it could keep them from getting there, right?
That is so important because if people get into a habit of expressing themselves and what they're going through, and that can be journaling. It could also be sharing how you're feeling with a partner or a friend, just getting that information out and out of your head, I think is the secret sauce, if you will, rather than letting the ruminative patterns just stay within you, just kicking around in your head. And with journaling, like this is going back to the 90s or maybe even 80s, but psychologist Jamie Pennebaker, who's was at, I don't know if he's still there, at UT Austin, he and others looked into expressive writing and this ability to articulate kind of what's going on, especially when you encounter something that stressed you out or made you depressed or whatever. Mm-hmm. Just the act of putting words down on the page and focusing in on that event and how it impacted you is kind of, you know, more structured journaling, if you will. But that has a lot of positive effects. But now, like you're saying, with AI, you have an agent. It's a non-human agent, but it is a dynamic, an intelligent agent that is going to say back to you what you've already given it, but in ways that maybe you didn't think about before. It could repackage it, restructure it, and say, oh, it sounds like you're da-da-da-da. And to be honest, that's not that unlike a mental health professional who listens to you. And I think, like you're saying, for the majority of people, having that access to something like that on a regular basis before they're in this acute crisis mode is huge.
I know.
And we haven't talked yet about the loneliness epidemic and just the fact that so many people, even if they're married or they have social connections, they're still experiencing tremendous levels of loneliness. But having an AI agent, the way that it's, you know, the way that it's set up in Brighton right now in the app, that can get a person out of that, you know, thought pattern. And like I said, how does that set them up for other interactions? Like it can get them clear about what they're thinking by having things written back to them. Mm-hmm. And that could, you know, that can lead to an insight or a light bulb going off. But then it could also say, oh, wow, yeah, like I guess I really care about this friend. Maybe I should reach out to them again. And then it's going to affect their real world interactions. And that's where, you know, you have a wonderful domino effect.
I think the people that don't really understand the differences think they're mutually exclusive.
Right.
They think it's therapy or pre-therapy. And I'm like, you're always on the, you're one phone call away from needing mental health therapy. You're like one call, like you got a call, your spouse dies in a car accident.
Right.
And now you're going to have PTSD the rest of your life. You know, you're going to be some defense mechanism is going to kick in, you know, and I went through all that complete shock. You know, I was like anointed, like one of the strongest people that everyone knew me thought I was just bulletproof, you know, and then you go through 5 years of burying half your family.
You
are emotionally naked. You are stripped down to your core essence and your core being. And I think for something like Brighton for us wasn't the end all be all. Like we weren't trying to come in and save everybody. Cause first of all, we don't think everyone's broken. You know? And so we intentionally wanted to be kind of away from telehealth and from, you know, and again, you know, was that a great move on our end? I think so, because if you look at the demographics, again, the size of Gen Z specifically, which is 2.56 billion humans, third of the world's population, the largest generation in human history. And a lot of them are doing okay. They're doing okay. They're not in crisis mode. We assume that they all are just a train wreck, but I, you know, I've got Gen Zers in my life right now that are amazing. But they're human. I know that they're capable of having, you know, very dark thoughts or struggling concerns or imposter syndrome, all these things. So I think what we're trying to look at this is we are an arrow in the quiver for those people looking to either get back on the horse. They've been knocked off. They're depressed. They're suicidal, whatever. Or you have a larger set of people that are just kind of okay. They get up, they feel pretty good. They're going through work. They're nervous about tests. They're nervous about a relationship, but that's what makes us human.
Right. Absolutely.
And we don't want to take that away.
No.
So I think there's this insane rush to like want to this come in and fix everybody that's broken. And most people aren't really broken. Yeah. So going back to AI journaling, you know, do you see concerns with some of this AI being able to be manipulative or can be taught to be deceptive? I mean, do you see issues? And I know on our app, Carson's done a good job building guardrails. So we've mitigated a lot of that, but the speed that AI is going, I think as a founder of this initiative that we need to be very sensitive to those type of concerns. Do you have concerns about that with AI?
I do. And it's not so much that I don't think some companies are going to take the proper precautions and put up guardrails as Brighton is doing, but it's more what I'm concerned about is a young person, let's say they're late middle school, early high school, and they just randomly sign up to, you know, for an account with some, you know, maybe more obscure AI chatbot or character-based chatbot. And they have no way of knowing or discerning what makes this AI safer than this AI.
Right.
So giving them a toolkit of kind of critical thinking skills to approach AI in a way and say, oh, actually, Brighton, because of how it's been set up, is safer because of this, and it fits my needs better, whereas this app, I'm not so sure, so I'm going to stay away from it. Because a young person, especially if they're desperate in the sense that they're looking for an answer and looking for help, and maybe they're in crisis mode, maybe they're not, but they might just stumble into an AI tool that it doesn't have those safety precautions and guardrails set up. And it can go south really quickly, depending on what tool they're using. So even though young people are incredibly tech savvy and probably savvier than I am now, for sure, with a lot of these things, I'm concerned because they haven't fully developed yet. They haven't fully developed their prefrontal cortex and other judgment decision-making capabilities where they can just take a step back and say, hey, like maybe I should be more discriminating with respect to which tool I use and to understand the why of it. Why is it concerning that an AI tool can be manipulative or too empathetic? And if a person has thoughts of harming themselves, you don't want a tool that's going to follow them through that whole thought process. You want to put a stopgap and, you know, so I have concerns, not because I think some companies are going to do it well and they're going to continue to make improvements and make it better and safer, but not all will and not all will initially. And it is the Wild West. I mean, whenever you have a technological revolution, you're going to have this period of instability and a lot of variability in the products and the tools that are getting developed. So I just wouldn't want to see a young person wade into that unwittingly. And potentially, there in some cases, there could be potential for severe harm.
So, Rich, I wanted to talk a little bit about this opportunity that we've been given you've given to us about your school there. Maybe talk a little bit about your school, where it's located, what the emphasis is, or your class, the specific class you teach. And what you want to get out of, like, what does it look like for you to have a successful partnership here?
Yeah.
For us to actually have an opportunity to have your wonderful students over there actually try an app. It happens to be ours, but to try it. And then how are you going to test it? Like, what's the how do you show the efficacy that it's working?
Yeah. So I'm at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I direct the Social Neuroscience of Affective Processes Lab, or SNAP Lab, and my students and I are going to be doing a pilot study where we're interested in getting first-year students who've just come to campus, getting them to think about their values, what they care about, and how they can live out their 4 years of college in alignment with those values. So Brighton, I think, makes a lot of sense to incorporate into that work because we want to give students a tool, especially when they're, you know, kind of coming and going and in their day-to-day routines, a tool where they can have the ability to reflect on their values and what their college life is going to look like. And then, of course, connecting that experience in the app with their peers, because the goal of this pilot study to look at some initial measures of efficacy is just to see whether having this support system with the help of the Brighton app can lead to positive outcomes with respect to mental health and well-being throughout the first year. So WPI already has some great support structures for incoming first-year students, but now it's a question of can we do even more to enhance wellness and give students that autonomy and power to kind of plan out their own wellness journey with their values in mind. And I should say, too, that this values-based approach is adapted from acceptance and commitment therapy, because I'm a firm believer in taking evidence-based aspects of psychotherapy to make it more accessible, because it would be potentially beneficial to a lot of students as well. So that's the overall idea.
I think the the challenge to me in any of these type of clinical studies, I guess we could say, is that mental wellness isn't linear. And so we could have your students go in one day, and let's say they all did well on a test, or the majority of them did, or their relationships are healthy, or their family life's good, or their football team won during that weekend. So they're in a good mood on Monday morning, and now they take this assessment. And it does well. And, you know, even a semester or a year or 5 years probably isn't a real good testing time frame. And then within by Thursday or Friday, maybe they didn't do well on a test. Maybe they got dumped by their girlfriend and now mom and dad are fighting again. So the inability to constantly assess, I guess, is one challenge. The other thing I would say is that being nonlinear, it's okay to have setbacks in your mental health. I mean, if you're having a really good day and you score well, and then Friday you're having a bad day, the fact that we even call it bad, I think, is a problem, because it shouldn't be judged. It's just you're having a day, and the day happens to be relative to another day isn't as good. It doesn't mean that day is bad. So that is, I think, that's systemic in any app or any clinical study. They're very limited, and that's when investors or people always want to see, well, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? And I'm like, that's a good question, because I don't know if any app could honestly give you evidence, because mental health doesn't just do this. It does this all over the board.
And you bring up a great point, because whenever we're repeatedly assessing for whatever it is, any type of indicator or outcome measure of interest, what time scale are we talking about, and how frequently are we assessing? Very relevant questions. But I will say, thankfully, there are statistical modeling techniques that take that into account, where if you have enough measurements, let's say you have 6 to 7 measurements over a few months, say, right? Even with that variability that's kind of baked in and assumed, you can still extract from the data some trends. Especially if you have a group that maybe didn't have, like a control group that didn't have an app or some other additional factor that might be impacting these things. So you're absolutely right. But I think with some careful design decisions and considerations with the study, some of that can be mitigated. Not all of it, but some of it can be mitigated for sure. And what's great about thinking about like the relativity of it, like is it a good day or just not as good day or a bad day, like all of that, that's all valid. But I think what's great about this values-based approach is that you could be having a really shitty day, and you're perceiving it as that, and you're experiencing it as that, but then you could still take steps and small steps and behaviors to live in alignment with your values. You can, So that, so I think, important. For me, the values-based approach has a lot of potential, because it's not so much about the externalities of, oh, I aced that exam or not. But actually, I value learning, and I got a C or a D on that, but I went to the professor's office hours, and oh my gosh, I figured out where I was going. So it's like, it turns kind of the narrative on its head of just like, oh, it's all about performance metrics and grades and all of this stuff on paper. It's much deeper than that.
Well, I've always said for me, the goal was to make this experience less clinical, yet very credible. And I think the ability that our objective is to arm you with coping skills, coping mechanisms. You pick whether going to the gym is what you want to do for your health or cutting down your binge drinking on the weekends when you're in college. And so it isn't like us coming in to say, here's the answer. You're broken. We can fix you.
Right.
It's a very arrogant adult way to look at youth is that we always want to fix them, make up for the mistakes we made. Right. Well, first of all, they're not mistakes. As long as you don't die or go to prison or something, they aren't really mistakes.
Right.
They're life lessons.
You know?
And that transcends even in the business world. I mean, my middle son is running a retail resale shoe store here in Cedar Rapids or in Iowa City. And I tell him all the time, I said, you know, entrepreneurship, you have the cost of tuition of going to college. Well, when you're in the real world, the tuition of being an entrepreneur is not making payroll or falling behind your bills. So I think it's trying to let young people know that A, you're never going to completely figure this out. There is no pill or antidote. There's no, there's no one coming to save you.
No.
You have to figure out ways that when your relationship ends or you don't get to that college you want to go to, or your mom and dad get divorced or you get in a fender bender, you're going to have to figure out ways to reach back, pull that arrow out, and then slay that beast that's in front of you.
Exactly.
And if you don't, you're going to end up going into alcoholism or drug addiction or pornography or gambling addiction or it goes on and on. And then at that point, you're in treatment.
Right.
I think we can head off a lot of these fires that are out there. And I think I've said this before on LinkedIn on a post and somebody liked the way I phrased it, but I said, we think we're throwing water on a raging fire. What reality is right now, we're throwing gasoline on it.
With
the DSM, with over-labelizing, over-pathologizing. And so there's a subtle dance going on with being a founder and CEO of an app that's trying to be preventative, yet take advantage of this wonderful AI thing that's come about that really wasn't even on the forefront a couple of years ago. Well, let's do this. We're wrapping up our time, but did you have any questions for me or any things you want to end this with today?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just curious, as you look ahead to the future, not that we know what's going to happen, of course, but what would success look like for you in Brighton 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
Yeah. I mean, going on the same premise that success isn't linear, that, you know, you step forward, you step back. I think for me, success would be if some night you got a text from one of your students saying, hey, you know, Mr. Lopez, I was struggling in your class. I didn't really give my best focus, but I've been using the app and I can tell you I feel a lot better. That would be like validation for me. And sometimes it's the littlest things like that. I get texts, I get people that share because you can share your journal entries. So I get young adults that will share their journal entries with me.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though being on this side of the fence is the daily grind, the up and down, I'm 59, you know, and having to go out and raise money and do all this stuff is stressful. But when I get a text like that randomly on a Sunday, it warms my heart. It just kind of makes everything I went through to get here a little bit less of a difficult journey. But the other thing I'll add is, and this is just an alarming statistic. If it doesn't depress you, I don't know what would. 909 good people die every day in the United States from the deaths of despair.
Yep.
You have to think about this for a minute. 909 people in the United States get the call I got twice. And that's a death, somebody from overdose, alcohol, and suicide. Okay. But think of the families that death hasn't shown up yet and the devastation and destruction. So you don't have to have death like I did to destroy a family. We were having foundational problems in our family before Seth died. And so, sure, the media, the statistics, the experts like to focus on the what I call the death statistics. The reality is, the living statistics are probably more destructive to the fabric of our families here in the United States. So back to your question, what would be a result for me would be to lower that number.
Yeah.
And someone said, why 909?
Yeah.
And I said, because 8 and 9 could have been Prudence and Seth.
Right.
So every single number on that statistic is important to me. I'm not going to round it down. Because it could be someone's child that I took off that.
Yes.
So to me, again, I think success for me, and we're just honored to have this opportunity, would be for you and your students and your community to see the benefits of this, because that trickles all the way throughout the universe in reality.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, great. Listen, if people want to reach out to you, say on LinkedIn or are you on other social media platforms, maybe give out your ways they can contact you.
Yeah, LinkedIn's probably best. And then you could also just Google my name, Richard Lopez, WPI, and you'll find my email address as well. So, yeah.
All right, man. Well, thanks for being on the show and keep living undeterred, okay?
Will do. It's been a pleasure, Jeff. Thanks so much.
Thanks, man. Take care.